He drew out the letter they'd given him and tossed it on the table before the drinkers. One of them picked it up and turned it over in his hands, picking at the pink wax that sealed it. After a moment he said, "Parchment. What good is that? It's cheese we need, and meat." "Steel, you mean?" said the man beside him, a greybeard, whose left arm ended in the stump. "Swords, axes. Aye, and bows, 100 more bows, and men to loose the arrows." "Ironborn, do not surrender," said a third voice. "Tell that to my father. Lord Balin bent the knee when Robert broke his wall. Elsewise he would have died, as you will, if you do not yield." He gestured at the parchment. "Break the seal. Read the words. That is a safe conduct, written in Lord Ramsay's own hand. Give up your swords and come with me, and his lordship will feed you and give you leave to march unmolested to the stony shore and find a ship for home. Elsewise, you die."
"Is that a threat?" One of the cods pushed to his feet. A big man, but pup-eyed and wide of mouth, with dead white flesh. He looked as if his father had sired him on a fish, but he still wore a longsword.
"Dagon cod yields to no man."
"No, please, you have to listen."
The thought of what Ramsay would do to him if he crept back to camp without the garrison's surrender was almost enough to make him piss his breeches.
"Reek, reek, it rhymes with leek. Is that your answer?"
The words rang feebly in his ears.
"Does this codfish speak for all of you?"
The guard who had met him at the door seemed less certain.
"Victorian commanded us to hold."
He did.
"I heard him with my own ears. Hold here till I return," he told Kenning.
"Aye," said the one-armed man, "that's what he said. The king's moot called, but he swore that he'd be back, with a driftwood crown upon his head and 1,000 men behind him."
"My uncle is never coming back," Reek told them. "The Kingswood crowned his brother, Euron, and the Crow's Eye has other wars to fight." "You think my uncle values you?"
"He doesn't.
You are the ones he left behind to die. He scraped you off the same way he scrapes mud off his boots when he wades ashore."
Those words struck home. He could see it in their eyes, in the way they looked at one another, or frowned above their cups. "They all feared they'd been abandoned, but it took me to turn fear into certainty."
These were not the kin of famous captains, nor the blood of the great houses of the Iron Islands. These were the sons of thralls and salt wives.
"If we yield, we walk away?" said the one-armed man. "Is that what it says on this here writing?"
He nudged the roll of parchment, its wax seal still unbroken.
"Read it for yourself," he answered,
though he was almost certain that none of them could read.
"Lord Ramsay treats his captives honourably, so long as they keep faith with him. He's only taken toes and fingers and that other thing when he might have had my tongue or peeled the skin off my legs from heel to thigh. Yield up your swords to him and you will live."
"Liar!" Dagon Cod drew his longsword. "You're the one they call Turncloak. Why should we believe your promises?"
"He is drunk," Reek realized. "The ale is speaking. Believe what you want. I have brought Lord Ramsay's message. Now I must return to him. We'll sup on wild boar and neeps, washed down with strong red wine. Those who come with me will be welcome at the feast. The rest of you will die within a day. The Lord of the Dreadfort will bring his knights up the causeway, whilst his son leads his own men down on you from the north. No quarter will be granted. The ones that die fighting will be the lucky ones. Those who live will be given to the bug devils."
"Enough," snarled Dagon Cod. "You think you can frighten Ironborn with words. Begone, run back to your master, before I open your belly, pull your entrails out, and make you eat them.
He might have said more, but suddenly his eyes gaped wide. A throwing axe sprouted from the center of his forehead with a solid thunk. Cod's sword fell from his fingers. He jerked like a fish on a hook, then crashed, face first, onto the table. It was the one-armed man who flung the axe. As he rose to his feet, he had another in his hand.
"Who else wants to die?"
he asked the other drinker. "Speak up! I'll see you do!" Thin red streams were spreading out across the stone from the pool of blood where Dagon Cod's head had come to rest.
"Me? I mean to live. And that don't mean staying here to rot."
One man took a swallow of ale. Another turned his cup over to wash away a finger of blood before it reached the place where he was seated. No one spoke. When the one-armed man slid the throwing axe back through his belt, Reek knew he had won. He almost felt a man again.
"Lord Ramsay will be pleased with me."
He pulled down the Kraken banner with his own two hands, fumbling some because of his missing fingers, but thankful for the fingers that Lord Ramsay had allowed him to keep. It took the better part of the afternoon before the Ironborn were ready to depart. There were more of them than he would have guessed. 47 in the Gatehouse Tower, and another 18 in the Drunkard's Tower. Two of those were so close to dead that there was no hope for them. Another 5 too weak to walk. That still left 58 who were fit enough to fight. Weak as they were, they would have taken 3 times their own number with them if Lord Ramsay had stormed the ruins.
"He did well to send me," Reek told himself,
as he climbed back onto his stut to lead the ragged column back across the buggy ground to where the Northmen were encamped.
"Leave your weapons here," he told the prisoners. "Swords, bows, daggers, armed men will be slain on sight."
It took them thrice as long to cover the distance as it had taken Reek alone. Crude litters had been patched together for 4 of the men who could not walk. The 5th was carried by his son upon his back. It made for slow going, and all the Ironborn were well aware of how exposed they were, well within bowshot of the bug devils and their poisoned arrows.
"If I die, I die."
Reek only prayed the archer knew his business, so death would be quick and clean.
"A man's death, not the end Ralph Kenning suffered."
The one-armed man walked at the head of the procession, limping heavily. His name, he said, was Adrak Humble, and he had a rock wife and 3 salt wives back on Great Wick.
"3 of the 4 had big bellies when we sailed," he boasted, "and Humble's run to twins. First thing I'll need to do when I get back is count up my new sons. Might be I'll even name one after you, my lord."
"Aye, name him Reek," he thought, "and when he's bad, you can cut his toes off and give him rats to eat." He turned his head and spat, and wondered if Ralph Kenning hadn't been the lucky one. A light rain had begun to piss down out of the slate-grey sky by the time Lord Ramsay's camp appeared in front of them. A sentry watched them pass in silence. The air was full of drifting smoke from the cook fires drowning in the rain. A column of riders came wheeling up behind them, led by a lordling with a horse head on his shield.
"One of Lord Ryswell's sons," Reek knew. "Roger, or maybe Rickard." He could not tell the 2 of them apart.
"Is this all of them?" the rider asked, from atop a chestnut stallion.
"All that weren't dead, my lord."
"I thought there would be more.
We came at them 3 times, and 3 times they threw us back."
"We are Ironborn," he thought, and with a sudden flash of pride, and for half a heartbeat, he was a prince again. Lord Balin's son, the blood of Pike. Even thinking was dangerous, though. He had to remember his name.
"Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with weak."
They were just outside the camp when the baying of a pack of hounds told of Lord Ramsay's approach. Horsbane was with him, along with half a dozen of his favourites, Skinner and Sour Allen, and Damon Dance for Me, and the Walders, big and little too. The dogs formed around them, snapping and snarling at the strangers.
"The bastards' girls," Reek thought, before he remembered that one must never, never, never use that word in Ramsay's presence.
Reek swung down from saddle and took a knee.
"My lord, Moat Cailin is yours. Here are its last defenders."
"So few? I had hope for more. They were such stubborn foes." Lord Ramsay's pale eyes shone. "You must be starved, Damon, Allen, see to them. Wine and ale and all the food that they can eat. Skinner, show their wounded to our maesters."
"Aye, my lord."
A few of the ironborn muttered thanks before they shambled off toward the cook fires in the centre of the camp. One of the cods even tried to kiss Lord Ramsay's ring, but the hounds drove him back before he could get close, and Allison took a chunk of his ear. Even as the blood streamed down his neck, the man bobbed and bowed and praised his lordship's mercy. When the last one were gone, Ramsay Bolton turned his smile on Reek. He clasped him by the back of the head, pulled his face close, kissed him on his cheek, and whispered, "My old friend Reek, did they really take you for their prince? Oh, what bloody fools, these iron men! The guards are laughing."
"All they want is to go home, my lord."
"And what do you want, my sweet Reek?" Ramsay murmured, as softly as a lover. His breath smelled of mulled wine and cloves, so sweet. "Such valiant service deserves a reward. I cannot give you back your fingers or your toes, but surely there is something you would have of me. Shall I free you instead, Release you for my service? Do you want to go with them, return to your bleak isles in the cold grey sea, be a prince again? Or would you sooner stay my leal serving men?" A cold knife scraped along his spine.
"Be careful," he told himself. "Be very, very careful."
He did not like his lordship's smile, the way his eyes were shining, the spittle glistening at the corner of his mouth. He had seen such signs before.
"You are no prince. You're Reek. Just Reek. It rhymes with freak. Give him the answer that he wants." "My lord," he said, "my place is here with you. I'm your Reek. I only want to serve you. All I ask, a skin of wine that would be reward enough for me. Red wine. The strongest that ye have. All the wine a man can drink."
Lord Ramsay laughed. "You're not a man, Reek. You're just my creature. You'll have your wine there. Walder, see to it, and fear not. I won't return you to the dungeons. You have my word as a Bolton. We'll make a dog of you instead, meat every day, and I'll even leave you teeth enough to eat it. You can sleep beside my girls. Ben, do you have a collar for him?"
"I'll have one made, my lord," said old Ben Bones.
The old man did better than that. That night, besides the collar, there was a ragged blanket, too, and half a chicken. Reek had to fight the dogs for the meat, but it was the best meal that he'd had since Winterfell. And the wine. The wine was dark and sour, but strong. Squatting amongst the hounds, Reek drank until his head swam, retched, wiped his mouth, and drank some more. Afterwards he lay back and closed his eyes. When he woke, a dog was licking vomit from his beard, and dark clouds were scuttling across the face of a sickle moon. Somewhere in the night, men were screaming. He shoved the dog aside, rolled over, and went back to sleep. The next morning, Lord Ramsay dispatched three riders down the causeway to take word to his lord father that the way was clear. The flayed man of House Bolton was hoisted above the gatehouse tower, where Reek had hauled down the golden kraken of pike. Along the rotting plank road, wooden stakes were driven deep into the boggy ground. There the corpses festered, red and dripping.
63, he knew. There are 63 of them. One was short half an arm, another had a parchment shoved between his teeth, its wax seal still unbroken. 3 days later, the vanguard of Ruth Bolton's host threaded its way through the ruins and past the row of grisly sentinels. 400 mounted Freys, clad in blue and grey, their spear points glittering whenever the sun broke through the clouds. Two of old Lord Walter's sons led the van. One was brawny, with a massive jut of jaw and arms thick with muscle. The other had hungry eyes, close set above a pointed nose, a thin brown beard that did not quite conceal the weak chin beneath it, a bald head. Hustine and Anus, he remembered them from before he knew his name. Hustine was a bull, slow to anger but implacable once roused, and by repute the fiercest fighter of Lord Walder's get. Anus was older, crueler, and more clever. A commander, not a swordsman. Both were seasoned soldiers. The Northmen followed hard behind the van, their tattered banners streaming in the wind. Reek watched them pass. Most were afoot, and there were so few of them. He remembered the great host that marched south with young Wolf beneath the dire wolf of Winterfell. 20,000 swords and spears had gone off to war with Rob, or near enough to make no matter, but only 2 in 10 were coming back, and most of those were Dreadfort men. Back where the press was thickest, at the centre of the column, rode a man armoured in dark grey plate over a quilted tunic of blood-red leather. His rundles were wrought in the shape of human heads, with open mouths that shrieked in agony. From his shoulder streamed a pink woolen cloak embroidered with droplets of blood. Long streamers of red silk fluttered from the top of his closed helm. "No Cranach man will slay Roose Bolton with a poisoned arrow," Rick thought, when he first saw him. An enclosed wagon groaned along behind him, drawn by 6 heavy draft horses and defended by crossbowmen front and rear. Curtains of dark blue velvet concealed the wagon's occupants from watching eyes. Farther back came the baggage train, lumbering wains laden with provisions and loot taken in the war, and carts crowded with wounded men and cripples. And at the rear, more Freys. At least 1,000, maybe more. Bowmen, spearmen, peasants armed with scythes and sharpened sticks, free riders and mounted archers, and another 100 knights to stiffen them. Collared and chained, and back in rags again, Reek followed with the other dogs at Lord Ramsay's heels when his lordship strode forth to greet his father. When the rider in the dark armour removed his helm, however, the face beneath was not one that Reek knew. Ramsay's smile curled at the sight, and anger flashed across his face. "What is this, some mockery?" "Just caution," whispered Roose Bolton, as he emerged from behind the curtains of the enclosed wagon. The Lord of the Dreadfort did not have a strong likeness to his bastard son. His face was clean-shaven, smooth-skinned, ordinary, not handsome but not quite plain. Though Roose had been in battles, he bore no scars. Though well past 40, he was as yet unwrinkled, with scarce a line to tell of the passage of time. His lips were so thin that when he pressed them together, they seemed to vanish altogether. There was an agelessness about him, a stillness. On Roose Bolton's face, rage and joy looked much the same. All he and Ramsay had in common were their eyes.
"His eyes are ice," Reek wondered if Roose Bolton ever cried. "If so, do the tears feel cold upon his cheeks?"
Once a boy named Theon Greyjoy had enjoyed tweaking Bolton as they sat at council with Rob Stark, mocking his soft voice and making japes about leeches.
"He must have been mad. This is no man to jape with."
You had only to look at Bolton to know that he had more cruelty in his pinky toe than all the Freys combined.
"'Father!' Lord Ramsay knelt before his sire. Lord Ruth studied him for a moment. "'You may rise.' He turned to help two young women down from inside the wagon. The first was short and very fat, with a round red face and three chins wobbling beneath a sable hood. "'My new wife,' Ruth Bolton said. "'Lady Wilder, this is my natural son. Kiss your stepmother's hand, Ramsay.'
He did.
"'And I'm sure you will recall the Lady Arya, your betrothed.'
The girl was slim and taller than he remembered, but that was only to be expected.
"'Girls grow fast at that age.'
Her dress was grey wool, bordered with white satin. Over it she wore an ermine cloak, clasped with a silver wolf's head. Dark brown hair fell halfway down her back, and her eyes.
"'That is not Lord Eddard's daughter?'
Arya had her father's eyes, the grey eyes of the Starks. A girl her age might let her hair grow long, add inches to her height, see her chest fill out. But she could not change the colour of her eyes.
"'That's Sansa's little friend, the Stuart's girl, Jane. That was her name, Jane Poole.'
"'Lord Ramsay,' the girl dipped down before him. That was wrong as well.
The real Arya Stark would have spat into his face. "'I pray that I will make you a good wife and give you strong sons to follow after you.'
"'That you will,' promised Ramsay, "'and soon.' John. His candle had guttered out in a pool of wax, but morning light was shining through the shutters of his window. John had fallen asleep over his work again. Books covered his table, tall stacks of them. He'd fetched them up himself, after spending half the night searching through dusty vaults by lantern light. Sam was right. The books desperately needed to be sorted, listed, and put in order, but that was no task for Stuarts, who could neither read nor write. It would need to wait for Sam's return. If he does return. John feared for Sam and Maester Aemon. Cutter Pike had written from Eastwatch to report that the Stormcrow had sighted the wreckage of a galley along the coast of Skagos. Whether the broken ship was Blackbird, one of Stannis Baratheon's sail-sails, or some passing trader, the crew of the Stormcrow had not been able to discern. I meant to send Gilly and the babe to safety. Did I send them to their graves instead? Last night's supper had congealed beside his elbow, scarce touched. Dolorous Ed had filled his trencher almost overflowing, to allow Three-Finger Hobbs' infamous three-meat stew to soften the stale bread. The jest among the brothers was that the three meats were mutton, mutton, and mutton. But carrot, onion, and turnip would have been closer to the mark. A film of cold grease glistened atop the remains of the stew. Bowen Marsh had urged him to move into the old bear's former chambers in the King's Tower after Stannis vacated them. But John had declined. Moving into the King's chambers could too easily be taken to mean he did not expect the King to return. A strange listlessness had settled over Castle Black since Stannis had marched south, as if the Free Folk and the Black Brothers alike were holding their breath, waiting to see what would come. The yards and dining hall were empty more often than not. The Lord Commander's tower was a shell, the old common hall a pile of blackened timbers, and Harden's tower looked as if the next gust of wind would knock it over. The only sound of life that John could hear was the faint clash of swords coming from the yard outside the armory. Arn Emmett was shouting at Hop Robin to keep his shield up. We'd all best keep our shields up. John washed and dressed and left the armory, stopping in the yard outside just long enough to say a few words of encouragement to Hop Robin and Emmett's other charges.
He declined Tai's offer of a tail, as usual. He would have men enough about him. If it came to blood, two more would hardly matter. He did take Longclaw, though, and Ghost followed at his heels. By the time he reached the stable, Dolorous Ed had the Lord Commander's palfrey saddled and bridled and waiting for him. The wains were forming up beneath Bowen Marsh's watchful eye. The Lord Steward was trotting down the column, pointing and fussing, his cheeks red from the cold. When he spied John, they reddened even more.
"Lord Commander, are you still intent on this folly?" finished John.
"Please tell me you are not about to say folly, my lord."
"Yes, I am.
We have been over this. East Watch wants more men. The Shadow Tower wants more men, Grey Guard and Ice Mark as well. I have no doubt. And we have 14 other castles still sitting empty. Long leagues of wall that remain unwatched and undefended." Marsh pursed his lips.
"Lord Commander Mormont is dead,
and not at worldling hands, but at the hands of his own sworn brothers, men he trusted. Neither you nor I can know what he would or would not have done in my place." John wheeled his horse around. "Enough talk. Away." Dolorous Ed had heard the entire exchange. As Bowen Marsh trotted off, he nodded towards his back and said,
"Pomegranates, all those seeds, a man could choke to death. I'd sooner have a turnip. Never knew a turnip to do a man any harm."
It was at times like this that John missed Maester Aemon the most. Clydes tended to the ravens well enough, but he had not a tenth of Aemon Targaryen's knowledge or experience, and even less of his wisdom. Bern was a good man in his way, but the wound he had taken at the Bridge of Skulls had hardened his attitudes, and the only song he ever sang now was his familiar refrain about sealing the gates. Athel Yarwick was as stolid and unimaginative as he was taciturn, and the First Rangers seemed to die as quick as they were named. "The Night's Watch has lost too many of its best men," John reflected, as the wagons began to move. "The Old Bear, Corran Halfhand, Donal Noy, Jarman Buckwell, my uncle." A light snow began to fall as the column made its way south along the King's Road, the long line of wagons wending past fields and streams and wooded hillsides, with a dozen spearmen and a dozen archers riding escort. The last few trips had seen some ugliness at Molestown. A little pushing and shoving, some muttered curses, a lot of sullen looks. Bowen Marsh felt it best not to take chances, and for once he and John were agreed. The Lord Steward led the way. John rode a few yards back, Dolorous Ed Tollett at his side. Half a mile south of Castle Black, Ed urged his garron close to John's and said,
"My lord, look up there, the big drunkard on the hill."
The drunkard was an ash tree, twisted sideways by centuries of wind. And now it had a face, a solemn mouth, a broken branch for a nose, two eyes carved deep into the trunk, gazing north up the King's Road toward the castle and the wall. The wildlings brought their guards with them, after all. John was not surprised. Men do not give up their guard so easily. The whole pageant that Lady Melisandre had orchestrated beyond the wall suddenly seemed as empty as a mummer's farce. "Looks a bit like you, Ed," he said, trying to make light of it.
"Aye, my lord, I don't have leaves growing out of my nose, but elsewise, Lady Melisandre won't be happy."
"She's not like to see it. See that no one tells her."
"She sees things in those fires, though.
Smoke and cinders,
and people burning. Me, most like, with leaves up my nose. I always feared I'd burn, but I was hoping to die first."
John glanced back at the face, wondering who had carved it. He had posted guards around Molestown, both to keep his crows away from the wildling women and to keep the free folk from slipping off southward to raid. Whoever had carved up the ash had eluded his sentries plainly,
and if one man could slip through the cordon, others could as well.
I could double the guard again, he thought sourly, waste twice as many men, men who might otherwise be walking the wall. The wagons continued on their slow way south, through frozen mud and blowing snow. A mile farther on, they came upon a second face, carved into a chestnut tree that grew beside an icy stream, where its eyes could watch the old plank bridge that spanned its flow.
"Twice as much trouble," announced Dolorous Ed.
The chestnut was leafless and skeletal, but its bare brown limbs were not empty. On a low branch, overhanging the stream, a raven sat, hunched, its feathers ruffled up against the cold. When it spied John, it spread its wings and gave a scream. When he raised his fist and whistled, the big black bird came flapping down, crying, "Corn! Corn! Corn!" "Corn for the free folk," John told him. "None for you." He wondered if they would all be reduced to eating ravens before the coming winter had run its course. The brothers on the wagons had seen this face as well, John did not doubt. No one spoke of it, but the message was plain to read for any man with eyes. John had once heard Mansreda say that most kneelers were sheep. "Now a dog can herd a flock of sheep," the king beyond the wall had said, "but free folk, well, some are shadow cats and some are stones. One kind prowls where they please and will tear your dogs to pieces. The other will not move at all unless you kick them." Neither shadow cats nor stones were like to give up the gods they had worshipped all their lives to bow down before one they hardly knew. Just north of Molestown, they came upon the third watcher, carved into the huge oak that marked the village perimeter, its deep eyes fixed upon the king's road. "That is not a friendly face," John Snow reflected. The faces that the first men and the children of the forest had carved into the weirwoods in eons past had stern or savage visages more oft than not. But the great oak looked especially angry, as if it were about to tear its roots from the earth and come roaring after them. "Its wounds are as fresh as the wounds of the men who carved it." Molestown had always been larger than it seemed. Most of it was underground, sheltered from the cold and snow. That was more true than ever now. The Magna of Thin had put the empty village to the torch when he passed through, on his way to attack Castle Black, and only heaps of blackened beams and old scorched stones remained above ground. But down beneath the frozen earth, the vaults and tunnels and deep cellars still endured, and that was where the free folk had taken refuge, huddled together in the dark, like the moles from which the village took its name. The wagons drew up in a crescent, in front of what had once been the village smithy. Nearby, a swarm of red-faced children were building a snow fort, but they scattered the sight of the black-cloth brothers, vanishing down one hole or another. A few moments later, the adults began to emerge from the earth. A stench came with them, the smell of unwashed bodies and soiled clothing, of night soil and urine. John saw one of his men wrinkle his nose and say something to the man beside him. Some jape about the smell of freedom, he guessed. Too many of his brothers were making japes about the stench of the savages in Molestown. Pig ignorance, John thought. The free folk were no different than the men of the night's watch. Some were clean, some dirty. But most were clean at times and dirty at other times. This stink was just the smell of 1,000 people jammed into cellars and tunnels that had been dug to shelter no more than 100. The wildlings had done this dance before. Wordless, they formed up in lines behind the wagons. There were 3 women for every man, many with children, pale, skinny things, clutching at their skirts. John saw very few babes in arms. The babes in arms died during the march, he realized, and those who survived the battle died in the king's stockade. The fighters had fared better. 300 men of fighting age, Justin Massey had claimed in council. Lord Harwood Fell had counted them. There will be spear wives, too, 50, 60, maybe as many as 100. Fell's count had included men who had suffered wounds, John knew. He saw a score of those. Men on crude crutches, men with empty sleeves and missing hands, men with one eye or half a face, a legless man carried between two friends, and everyone grey-faced and gaunt. Broken men, he thought. The whites are not the only sort of living dead. Not all the fighting men were broken, though. Half a dozen thens in bronze-scale armour stood clustered round one cellar stair, watching solemnly and making no attempt to join the others. In the ruins of the old village smithy, John spied a big, bald slab of a man he recognized as Halleck, the brother of Harmer, Dog's Head. Harmer's pigs were gone, though. Eaten, no doubt. Those two in furs were horn-foot men, as savage as they were scrawny, barefoot even in the snow. There are wolves amongst these sheep still. Val had reminded him of that on his last visit with her.
Free folk and kneelers are more alike than not, John Snow. Men are men and women women, no matter which side of the wall we were born on. Good men and bad, heroes and villains, men of honour, liars, cravens, brutes. We have plenty, as do you.
She was not wrong. The trick was telling one from the other, parting the sheep from the goats. The black brothers began to pass out food. They'd brought slabs of hard salt beef, dried cod, dried beans, turnips, carrots, sacks of barley meal and wheaten flour, pickled eggs, barrels of onions and apples. "You can have an onion or an apple," John heard Hairy Hal tell one woman, "but not both. You gotta pick." The woman did not seem to understand.
"I need two of each. One of each for me, t'other's for my boy, he's sick. But an apple will set him right."
Hal shook his head. "He has to come get his own apple. Or onion, not both. Same as you. Now, is it an apple or an onion? Be quick about it now. There's more behind you."
"An apple," she said. And he gave her one, an old dried thing, small and withered.
Move along, woman," shouted a man three places back. "It's cold out here."
The woman paid the shout no mind.
"Another apple," she said to Hairy Hal, "for my son, please. This one is so little."
Hal looked to John. John shook his head. They would be out of apples soon enough. If they started giving two to everyone who wanted to, the latecomers would get none.
"Out of the way," a girl behind the woman said.
Then she shoved her in the back. The woman staggered, lost her apple, and fell. The other foodstuffs in her arms went flying. Beans scattered. A turnip rolled into a mud puddle. A sack of flour split and spilled its precious contents in the snow. Angry voices rose in the old tongue and the common. More shoving broke out at another wagon.
"It's not enough," an old man snarled. "You bloody crows are starving us to death."
The woman who'd been knocked down was scrabbling on her knees after her food. John saw the flash of naked steel a few yards away. His own bowmen knocked arrows to their strings. He turned in his saddle. "Rory, quiet them." Rory lifted his great horn to his lips and blew, "Oh!" The tumult and the shoving died. Heads turned. A child began to cry. Mormont's raven walked from John's left shoulder to his right, bobbing its head and muttering,
"Snow! Snow! Snow!"
John waited until the last echoes had faded, then spurred his palfrey forward, where everyone could see him. "We're feeding you as best we can, as much as we can spare. Apples, onions, neeps, carrots. There's a long winter ahead for all of us, and our stores are not inexhaustible."
"You crows eat good enough," Halleck shoved forward.
"For now,
We hold the wall. The wall protects the realm and you, now. You know the foe we face? You know what's coming down on us? Some of you have faced them before, whites and white walkers. Dead things with blue eyes and black hands. I've seen them too, fought them, sent a few to hell. They kill, then they send your dead against you. The giants were not able to stand against them, nor you Thens, the Ice River clans, the Hornfoots, the Free Folk, and as the days grow shorter and the nights colder, they are growing stronger. You left your homes and came south in your hundreds and your thousands. Why? But to escape them, to be safe. Well, it's the wall that keeps you safe. It's us that keeps you safe, the Black Crows you despise. Safe and starved, said a squat woman with a wind-burned face, a spear-wife by the look of her. You want more food? Asked John. The food for fighters. Help us hold the wall, and you'll eat as well as any crow. Or as poorly, when the food runs short. A silence fell. The wildlings exchanged wary looks. Eat! The raven muttered. Corn! Corn! Fight for you! This voice was thickly accented. Sigorn, the young Magna of Thenn, spoke the common tongue haltingly as best. Not fight for you! Kill you better! Kill all you! The raven flapped its wings. Kill! Kill! Sigorn's father, the old Magna, had been crushed beneath the falling stair during his attack on Castle Black. I would feel the same if someone asked me to make common cause with the Lannisters, John told himself. Your father tried to kill us all, he reminded Sigorn. The Magna was a brave man, yet he failed. And if he had succeeded, who would hold the wall? He turned away from the Thens. Winterfell's walls were strong as well, but Winterfell stands in ruins today, burned and broken. A wall is only as good as the men defending it. An old man with a turnip cradled against his chest said,
You kill us, you starve us, and now you want to make us slaves.
A chunky red-faced man shouted assent.
I'd sooner go naked than wear one of them black rags on my back.
One of the spear wives laughed.
Even your wife don't want to see you naked, Butts.
A dozen voices all began to speak at once. The Thens were shouting in the old tongue. A little boy began to cry. Jon Snow waited until all of it had died down, then turned to Hairy Hal and said, Hal, what was it that you told this woman? Hal looked confused.
About the food, you mean? An apple or an onion, that's all I said. They got to pick.
You have to pick, Jon Snow repeated. All of you. No one is asking you to take our vows, and I do not care what gods you worship. My own gods are the old gods, the gods of the north. But you can keep the Red God or the Seven or any other god who hears your prayers. It's spears we need, bows, eyes along the wall. I will take any boy above the age of 12 who knows how to hold a spear or string a bow. I will take your old men, your wounded, and your cripples, even those who can no longer fight. There are other tasks they may be able to perform, fletching arrows, milking goats, gathering firewood, mucking out our stables. The work is endless. And yes, I will take your women, too. I have no need of blushing maidens looking to be protected, but I will take as many spear wives as will come.
And girls?
A girl asked. She looked as young as Arya had the last time John had seen her. 16 and older.
You're taking boys as young as 12.
Down in the Seven Kingdoms, boys of 12 were often pages or squires. Many had been training at arms for years. Girls of 12 were children. These are wildlings, though. As you will. Boys and girls as young as 12, but only those who know how to obey an order. That goes for all of you. I will never ask you to kneel to me.
but I will set captains over you, and sergeants who will tell you when to rise and when to sleep, where to eat, when to drink, what to wear, when to draw your swords and loose your arrows. The men of the Night's Watch serve for life. I will not ask that of you. But so long as you are on the wall, you will be under my command. Disobey an order, and I'll have your head off. Ask my brothers if I won't. They've seen me do it. Off! Screamed the old bear's raven. Off, off, off! The choice is yours, Jon Snow told them. Those who want to help us hold the wall, return to Castle Black with me, and I'll see you armed and fed. The rest of you, get your turnips and your onions, and crawl back inside your holes. The girl was the first to come forward.
I can fight. My mother was a spear wife.
John nodded. She may not even be 12, he thought, as she squirmed between a pair of old men. But he was not about to turn away his only recruit. A pair of striplings followed her, boys no older than 14. Next, a scarred man with a missing eye.
I seen them too, the dead ones. Even crows are better than that.
A tall spearwife, an old man on crutches, a moon-faced boy with a withered arm, a young man whose red hair reminded John of Ygritte. And then Halleck.
I don't like you, Crow, he growled, but I never liked the manse neither, no more than my sister did. Still, we fought for him. Why not fight for you?
The dam broke then. Halleck was a man of note. Mance was not wrong. Free folk don't follow names or little cloth animals sewn on a tunic, the king beyond the wall had told him. They won't dance for coins. They don't care how you style yourself or what that chain of office means or who your grandsire was. They follow strength. They follow the man. Halleck's cousins followed Halleck, then one of Harmer's banner-bearers, then men who'd fought with her, then others who had heard tales of their prowess, greybeards and green boys, fighting men in their prime, wounded men and cripples, a good score of spear-wives, even 3 horn-footmen. But no Thins. The Magna turned and vanished back into the tunnels, and his bronze-clad minions followed hard at his heels. By the time the last withered apple had been handed out, the wagons were crowded with wildlings, and they were 63 stronger than when the column had set out from Castle Black that morning. "What will you do with them?" Bowen Marsh asked John on the ride back up the King's Road. "Train them, arm them, and split them up. Send them where they're needed. East Watch, the Shadow Tower, Icemark, Greyguard. I mean to open 3 more forts as well." The Lord Steward glanced back.
"Women, too? Her brothers are not accustomed to having women amongst them, my lord. Their vows. There will be fights, rapes.
These women have knives and know how to use them.
And the first time one of these spear-wives slits the throat of one of our brothers, what then?"
"We will have lost a man," said John. "But we have just gained 63. Now, you're good at counting, my lord. Correct me if I'm wrong, but my reckoning leaves us 62 ahead." Marsh was unconvinced.
"You have added 63 more mouths, my lord. But how many are fighters? And whose side will they fight on? If it's the others at the gates, most like they'll stand with us, I grant you. But if it's Tormund Giantsbane or the Weeping Man come calling with 10,000 howling killers, what then?"
"Then we'll know. So let us hope it never comes to that." Tyrion. He dreamt of his lord father and the Shrouded Lord. He dreamt that they were one and the same. And when his father wrapped stone arms around him and bent to give him his grey kiss, he woke with his mouth dry and rusty, with a taste of blood, and his heart hammering in his chest. "Our dear dwarf has returned to us," Holden said. Tyrion shook his head, to clear away the webs of dream. The sorrows. I was lost in the sorrows.
I am not dead.
That remains to be seen. The half-maester stood over him. Duck, be a fine fowl, and boil some broth for our little friend here. He must be famished. He was on the shy maid, Tyrion saw, under a scratchy blanket that smelled of vinegar.
The sorrows are behind us. It was just a dream I dreamed, as I was drowning. Why do I stink of vinegar?
Limor has been washing you with it. Some say it helps prevent the grayscale. I am inclined to doubt that, but there's no harm in trying. It was Limor who forced the water from your lungs after Griff had pulled you up. You were as cold as ice, and your lips were blue. Yandri said we ought to throw you back, but the lad forbade it.
The prince?
Memory came rushing back. The stone man reaching out with cracked grey hands, the blood seeping from his knuckles.
He was heavy as a boulder, pulling me under. Griff brought me up. He must hate me, or he would have let me die. How long have I been sleeping? What place is this?
Selhoris. Holden produced a small knife from his sleeve. Here, he said, tossing it underhand at Tyrion. The dwarf flinched. The knife landed between his feet and stood quivering in the deck. He plucked it out.
What's this?
Take off your boots. Prick each of your toes and fingers.
That sounds painful.
I hope so. Do it. Tyrion yanked off one boot, then the other, peeled down his hose, squinted at his toes. It seemed to him they looked no better or worse than usual. He poked gingerly at one big toe.
Harder, urged Holden Halfmaester. Do you want me to draw blood?
If need be.
I'll have a scab on every toe.
The purpose of the exercise is not to count your toes. I want to see you wince. So long as the pricks hurt, you are safe.
It is only when you cannot feel the blade that you will have cause to fear.
Grayscale, Tyrion grimaced. He stabbed another toe, cursed as a bead of blood welled up around the knife's point.
That hurt. Are you happy?
Dancing with joy.
Your feet smell worse than mine, Yellow.
Duck had a cup of broth.
Griff warned you not to lay hands upon the stone men.
Aye, but he forgot to warn the stone men not to lay their hands upon me.
As you prick, look for patches of dead grey skin.
For nails beginning to turn black, said Holden.
If you see such signs, do not hesitate. Better to lose a toe than a foot. Better to lose an arm than spend your days wailing on the bridge of dream. Now the other foot, if you please. Then your fingers.
The dwarf recrossed his stunted legs and began to prick the other set of toes.
Shall I prick my prick as well?
It would not hurt.
It would not hurt you, is what you mean, though I had as well sliced it off, for all the use I make of it.
Feel free. We will have it tanned and stuffed, and sell it for a fortune. A dwarf's cock has magical powers.
I've been telling all the women that for years.
Tyrion drove the dagger's point into the ball of his thumb, watched the blood bead up, sucked it away.
How long must I continue to torture myself? When will we be certain that I'm clean?
Truly, said the half-maester, never. You swallowed half the river. You may be going grey even now, turning to stone from inside out, starting with your heart and lungs. If so, pricking your toes and bathing in vinegar will not save you. When you've done, come have some broth. The broth was good, though Tyrion noted that the half-maester kept the table between them as he ate. The shy maid was moored to a weathered pier on the east bank of the Rhoyne. Two piers down, a volantine river galley was discharging soldiers. Shops and stalls and storehouses huddled beneath a sandstone wall. The towers and domes of the city were visible beyond it, reddened by the light of the setting sun.
No, not a city. Selhoris was still accounted a mere town, and was ruled from old Volantis. This was not Westeros. L'Amour emerged on deck, with the prince in tow. When she saw Tyrion, she rushed across the deck to hug him.
The mother is merciful. We have prayed for you, Hugo.
You did at least. I won't hold that against you. Young Griff's greeting was less effusive. The princeling was in a solemn mood, angry that he had been forced to remain on the Shrymaid instead of going ashore with Yandri and Ysilla.
We only want to keep you safe, L'Amour told him. These are unsettled times.
Holden Halfmaester explained. On the way down from the Sorrows to Selhoris, we thrice glimpsed raiders moving south along the river's eastern shore, Dothraki. Once they were so close, we could hear their bells tinkling in their braids, and sometimes at night their fires could be seen beyond the eastern hills. We passed warships as well, Volantine river galleys, crammed with slave soldiers. The Triarchs fear an attack upon Selhoris, plainly.
Tyrion understood that quick enough. Alone amongst the major river towns, Selhoris stood upon the eastern bank of the Rhoyne, making it much more vulnerable to the Horse Lords than its sister towns across the river.
Even so, it is a small prize. If I were Carl, I would faint at Selhoris, let the Volantines rush to defend it, then swing south and ride hard for Volantis itself.
I know how to use a sword, young Griff was insisting. Even the bravest of your forebears kept his king's guard close about him in times of peril.
L'Amour had changed out of her scepter's robes into garbs more befitting the wife or daughter of a prosperous merchant.
Tyrion watched her closely. He had sniffed out the truth beneath the dyed blue hair of Griff and young Griff easily enough, and Yandri and Ysilla seemed to be no more than they claimed to be, whilst Duck was somewhat less.
L'Amour, though. Who is she, really? Why is she here? Not for gold, I'll judge. What is this prince to her? Was she ever a true scepter?
Holden took note of her change of garb as well.
What are we to make of this sudden loss of faith? I preferred you in your scepter's robes, L'Amour.
I preferred her naked, said Tyrion.
L'Amour gave him a reproachful look.
That is because you have a wicked soul. Scepter's robes scream of Westeros, and might draw unwelcome eyes onto us.
She turned back to Prince Aegon.
You are not the only one who must needs hide.
The lad did not seem appeased.
The perfect prince, but still half a boy for all that, with little and less experience of the world and all its woes.
Prince Aegon, said Tyrion, since we are both stuck aboard this boat, perhaps you will honour me with a game of Saivas to while away the hours. The prince gave him a wary look.
I am sick of Saivas.
Sick of losing to a dwarf, you mean? That pricked the lad's pride just as he'd known it would.
Go fetch the board and pieces. This time I mean to smash you.
They played on deck, sitting cross-legged behind the cabin. Young Griff arrayed his army for attack, with dragon, elephants, and heavy horse up front. A young man's formation, as bold as it is foolish. He risks all for the quick kill.
He let the prince have first move. Holden stood behind them, watching the play. When the prince reached for his dragon, Tyrion cleared his throat.
I wouldn't do that if I were you. It is a mistake to bring your dragon out too soon.
He smiled innocently. Your father knew the dangers of being overbold.
Did you know my true father?
Well, I saw him twice or thrice. But I was only 1 in 10 when Robert killed him, and mine own sire had me hidden underneath a rock. No, I cannot claim I knew Prince Rhaegar, not as your false father did,
Lord Cunnington was the prince's dearest friend.